Well, thank you again for coming today. This is an observance. It's not a celebration. I'm glad we have the opportunity to be here, and we thank DePaul University and Professor Yuki Miyamoto for setting up the room and making the arrangements for us. As she said, we attended a birthday party yesterday at the University of Chicago, which was appalling. You certainly want to celebrate and acknowledge a tremendous scientific achievement, but at least you should have the integrity to do it truthfully. And some of the programs we saw yesterday were so bereft of intellectual honesty as to really question the validity of the University of Chicago as an educational institution. Today, you're going to hear the other pieces that got left out yesterday, in the sense that for 6 years since the Fukushima disaster, Dr. Field, who you'll hear from in a moment, has been asking a very important question. We keep hearing about RADs and REMS and millions of bags of cubic feet of radioactive material and tuna fish. And the simple question is, in all of that, where are the people? Where is the discussion of the effects on people for the nuclear age? Even this symbolic artistic gesture this afternoon, the fireworks display at the University of Chicago at 3:25 p.m., the very moment, 75 years, to that moment, celebrates the mushroom cloud. You know, why not the atom itself? It's what we've become over these 75 years, and in large part because of the way the nuclear age is presented, because we've left people out of the discussion. And today, I'm really pleased to be able to present two people to you who have been asking this question and fighting to get people on the agenda, on the talking agenda for the nuclear age for decades. I've known Arnie Gunderson for quite a while now. He is the chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education. He will be the first speaker. He is an expert nuclear witness, trained nuclear engineer, former nuclear energy utility vice president. So we're not talking about someone who just came to the issue recently and has a grudge. This is someone who has observed things for 40 years. He is coming from data. He'll be followed by Dr. Norma Field, who I've had the pleasure to know for a number of decades now, who repeatedly goes back and forth to Japan to be in touch with the situation at Fukushima. She is a professor emeritus, as you can see in her program, at University of Chicago, Department of East Asian Languages, I believe, Japanese Studies. And she will get to the meat of today's agenda, where are the people? So we hope you will enjoy today's presentation. Help yourself to the literature in the back and refreshments over here. We will have a question and answer session at the end. If we don't get to your question today, it's important you take the material so that you can email it back to us, and we'll try and get back to you in a timely manner as best we can. Last piece, I guess, is we are taping this today, and we want to thank our friends at CanTV Chicago. This is the jewel in the crown of public media in Chicago, and it will be aired at a later date. But I say that if you don't want to be on film or on camera, make sure you avoid it. So, because there's nothing we can do. Stay out of the way. So, I will now welcome my friend Arnie Gunderson.
So, thanks everybody for coming. And thank you to DePaul for hosting this, and for NEIS for also hosting it. For those of you taking notes, it's Gunderson has an E in it, and so does Fairwinds in the middle of it. In any event, I wanted to kind of put Dave's introduction in perspective. I could sort of say I'm older than dirt, but I was going to school as a nuclear engineer when the Fukushima Daiichi reactors were being built. That was in the late 60s. But more importantly for Chicago, I was going to school when the Dresden reactors were being built, which are only crow flight less than 50 miles away from where we are today. The reason I bring Dresden up is that the two reactors at Dresden are identical to the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi. And keep that in mind as I talk about readings I've taken in Tokyo over the years compared to, which is about 130 miles away from Daiichi, compared to 50 miles for the reactors at Dresden. On the credentials, I think you did a great job, Dave. And for the academics in the room, I was a Atomic Energy Commission fellow back in the for my graduate degree, and now I'm a research fellow at the University of Vermont, in addition to being the chief engineer at Fairwinds. And recently, I had published a peer review report on the particle size of radiation in Japan. I'll get into that in a slide later, but I think it's important that there's a peer-reviewed journal out there. And Dave did not mention it, but while I was a senior vice president in the nuclear industry, I am also a nuclear whistleblower and have experienced the congressional hearings with John Glenn and a dramatic life change that might entail. I think you can imagine that. Well, where are the people? In 2011, we're almost 7 years into it now, people were forced to evacuate their communities, their cities, their ancestral homeland to because of the triple meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. And the question really should be, as Dave said in the introductory remarks, where are they now? Who watches out for them now? Who speaks for them now and who speaks to them now? Who helps them build new lives and move on from this event? And I think my conclusion is that no one does. I've been to Fukushima Prefecture 4 times in the last 6 years. And when you, Fukushima Prefecture, the term prefecture is essentially a state in the United States. They're essentially synonymous. And while Japan is sort of far away, you know, geographically, it's almost on the other side of the Northern Hemisphere. But in fact, the people there lived lives very similar to ours. So when I talk about the people, I think the nuclear industry has done an excellent job of removing us from them, when in fact they're as close as the person sitting next to us. Their kids play little leagues. They go to school. They coach soccer. They have jobs in the cities and jobs on the farms, and they grow their food organically. And until the disaster just totally disrupted their lives, their experience, their life experience, and our life experience are essentially identical. So this particular slide, and I have this one and one other I will be a geek during, but the rest of this is geek-free material. This particular slide is something from is a photograph from a scanning electron microscope. And it's of a radioactive particle we discovered in vacuum cleaner dust. And it came from, it's highly radioactive. It's essentially a piece of nuclear fuel. And we found it in Nagoya, which is about 300 crow flight miles from Fukushima Daiichi, in vacuum cleaner dust. Well, as I was struggling with trying to put a bow around this presentation, just this week, Japan Today had a headline, and it said, "Risky stalemate as science battles human fears at Fukushima." And I think that really encapsulates what I wanted to talk about today. The nuclear industry has, and the Japanese government, have co-opted the media. And what we've got here is a typical example in that one headline. It's as if science knows what's right, and then we have this irrational human fear that people just don't understand. You know, if they really knew the science, they would come back to their homes and play baseball on the fields and have a good time in life. Well, I'm a scientist, and I've been all my life, and I'm afraid. And when I saw this headline, I just said, shame on Japan Today for publishing a headline like that. The topic of today is using the internet to speak truth to power. And that's what we at Fairwinds have been doing since the disaster. And by power, we mean the worldwide nuclear industry, the national nuclear industries, and banks and politicians as well. When we speak truth to power, it's a group of citizens using the internet effectively to butt heads against the powers that be And this is something that didn't exist with Chernobyl and didn't exist with Three Mile Island. And what makes this point in history unique is that the internet has allowed us to transmit information faster and more accurately than we ever could have done back 20 years ago. So speaking truth to power is something that my wife Maggie and I have been doing together and at Fairwinds for a couple decades now. We've been married for 39 years, and we met when we were both in the nuclear industry. So we were sort of a nuclear family. But for me, and Maggie is the strategic thinker here, and I'm sort of just the talking head. But for me, this is really about giving people a voice in the international conversation about nuclear power. And on the opposite side of the argument are governments, the nuclear industry, and unfortunately, a co-opted media. So as I said, I've been to Japan four times, totaling 2 months of my life in the last four years. And I wanted to share my observations, and I promise there's only one geeky slide. But rather than spend a lot of time on rads and rems and becquerels and curies released and all that stuff, I really wanted to focus on the impact on the human beings that are involved. The first trip was in February of 2012. It was for a week. The second trip was in September of 2012, and it was for 10 days. And then in 2016, I was there for an entire month. And I just came back from another trip that ended in September, which was for 2 weeks, of gathering data and teaching scientists and citizens there how to collect data on their own. The key to this is crowdsourcing, another one of those inventions of the 21st century that didn't exist before. The last three trips, the first trip I'll get into was sponsored, but the last three trips that I took over there were crowdsourced. And I'm sure you all know what that means, but citizens in Japan and in the United States sponsored my travel and my lodging. And I, of course, donated my time. But, you know, there's some legitimate out-of-pocket costs that crowdsourcing has allowed us to do. Speaking truth to power and crowdsourcing sort of reminds me of that comment that when the Air Force needs a new bomber, they raise your taxes. When the library needs new books, they hold a bake sale. Mm-hmm. And really, crowdsourcing is the 21st century's equivalent to the bake sale. Before I get into my trip, so I want to talk about the background of the institutions in Japan that we were facing when we went over there. The first is Prime Minister Abe had passed a law called the State Secrets Act, and it can be interpreted as allowing the government to imprison journalists, teachers, scientists and others when they discuss Fukushima in a light that's unflattering to the government. It's a very loosely written law that terrifies journalists and other people. In fact, when I was over there recently, they urged me to get my samples done before I started my public speaking because they were afraid I might get thrown out of the country. During the same time I was over there, 6 months after the nuclear disaster, Prime Minister Abe declared that Fukushima was in something called cold shutdown. Now, in nuke speak, the jargon that I grew up with, that means that the plant is cool and you can begin to refuel it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's sort of like George Bush's comment about mission accomplished. And you know, 15 years later, we're still involved. The other piece of the puzzle is the relationship between the regulator and the government and the banks and Tokyo Electric. It's sort of those four pieces of the puzzle. I'll be using TEPCO frequently, but it stands for Tokyo Electric. And it was the largest nuclear utility and one of the largest utilities in the world. It turns out that 3 weeks after the disaster, the government, its regulators, the equivalent of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and TEPCO and their banks cut a deal. And the deal basically assured that TEPCO would survive. So while they should have been focused on the survival of its citizens, they basically said their top priority was the survival of Tokyo Electric. In addition, about a year after that, the Japanese government successfully lobbied to get the Tokyo Olympics into Japan. It's the Summer Olympics in 2020. This is really a blatant attempt to show that, to replace a public fear of radiation contaminating northern Japan with a feel-good event that like the Olympics. That's what's happening in Japan even today. And the last piece of this background that I went into was the censoring of doctors. I didn't realize it when I went over, but I've spoken to many doctors, and they're all under enormous pressure. When they see situations with people that clearly have a radiation-related illness, they're not allowed to diagnose it as such. They have to say it's stress. Now, what this is doing is several-fold. It's putting the burden of the illness back on the person who is in fact really ill. And it's also destroying the epidemiological record for scientists like me. So years from now, when we start to go back and look at what somebody may have died from or how they got their illness, we're going to go back into records that show stress-related illnesses as opposed to the real cause of those illnesses. That's the background against which my trips have been made. The first trip was sponsored by Shueisha. Maggie and I co-authored a book with a Japanese author. In English, the title is Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. It talks about the cause of the accident, but it also shows the Japanese an alternative approach to the future. And Shueisha was our publisher. They sponsored the first trip. Well, I was there for a week. The very first day, I spoke at the National Press Club. And at the National Press Club, I was the first person to talk about the cost of decontaminating not just the nuclear site, like it's happening at Zion, but in fact the whole state of Fukushima. The state of Fukushima is roughly the size of Connecticut. It's a big hunk of real estate. And at the time, Tokyo Electric was downplaying the cost of the decommissioning and the cleanup of the prefecture, saying it would be perhaps $10 billion. And I was the first one to say that the cost was in fact going to be $250 billion, or a quarter of $1 trillion. Now, finally, 6 years later, many think tanks in Japan have reached the same conclusion. But at the time, the Japanese government didn't want people to realize the impact of the disaster. I think it's a death by a thousand cuts, where if you don't tell them and then you just increase it by another $5 billion and another $5 billion, it kind of sneaks up on you. But we put it out there at Fairwinds that this is a quarter to a half a trillion dollar problem to clean up that prefecture. In the first trip, I collected 5 radioactive samples. This sample was from the roof of the publisher. I collected another sample at a children's playground, another at a Buddhist temple, another at a crack in the sidewalk. These are all in Tokyo, 140 miles away from the disaster. When I got back, I came into the country with 5 small bags of, of dirt, and I declared that dirt through customs, and I explained that I had collected dirt, and then I sent it to a laboratory. And what surprised me is the answer that I got back. What the lab told us was that the dirt we collected was so radioactive that if it were in America, it would have to be classified as radioactive waste. Now, Fairwinds published that, and the Associated Press also published it. And I think the next thing that happened is illustrative. The NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, questioned me and the reporter and actually tried to get the reporter fired. So to AP's credit, they stood behind me for the science and the reporter for the reporting. But the pressure to publish something that goes against the orthodoxy, if you will, even with good science, is astronomical. The other thing I learned after that, so now I had collected five samples, and I said, wow, Tokyo is quite contaminated. So then after that, through a Freedom of Information Act, there was an NRC release of emails. One of the NRC emails said all of northern Japan is an RCA. And the press completely missed the significance of that terrifying email. In Nukespeak, RCA means radiologically contaminated area. And what that means is there's some places in a nuclear plant where you can walk in civilian clothes. But there's other places that are so contaminated you can't walk in civilian clothes, that you have to put booties on and gloves and overalls. Those are called RCAs. And here, 3 days after Fukushima Daiichi, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission knew that all of northern Japan was a radiologically contaminated area. But yet you don't see people walking around in booties and gloves and throughout all of northern Japan. That's a secret that's been kept from the Japanese people. My second trip was a university tour, and this one and all the others were indeed crowdsourced. I was there for 10 days, spoke at the University of Tokyo, and also at the Diet. The Diet is Japan's parliament. When I was at the Diet, my presentation revolved around nuclear fuel pool fires. And I had a study from a national lab where they actually heated a piece of nuclear fuel electrically and proved that indeed nuclear fuel can catch fire in a fuel pool. So I showed this picture and many others of the nuclear fuel burning in air. Well, after my presentation, TEPCO came up and made their presentation. And they said there's no risk of fire in the fuel pool because there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn. Now, the Japanese audiences are normally very attentive, but there's not a lot of emotional feedback from the group to the speaker. And I have gotten used to that. But when Tokyo Electric said there's nothing in the fuel pool to burn, 500 people started to scream. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And my interpreter is talking in my ear and telling me what's going on. But it's an example of the absolute lack of trust that the Japanese people have in both their government and in the integrity of Tokyo Electric. The other thing I saw when I was there was how citizens were surrounding the Prime Minister's house. Every Friday at around 4 o'clock until about 8 o'clock, hundreds of thousands of people would materialize out of the subway and surround the Prime Minister's house, beating drums, making enormous noise, and there were also speakers there to talk to the crowd about the problem. And this went on for months. And I think that's another example of the lack of trust that the Japanese population has in their own government and in the integrity of their Prime Minister. And the most touching thing that happened to me on my second trip was when I was in Niigata. Niigata's on the west side of Japan. Fukushima's on the east side. And I met a woman who wanted to thank me for the work that Fairwinds did, and she spoke excellent English. And she explained to me that she had left Fukushima Prefecture with her two kids and was reestablishing a life in Niigata. And her husband had told her that if she didn't return, he was going to get a divorce. This is something that's quite commonly called the Fukushima divorce now. Well, she told me with tears in her eyes that she said, okay, I am not coming back. I'm not taking the kids back. So you'll have to divorce me. But before you do, I want you to do one thing. And he said, sure, what is it? And she said, I want you to watch the Fairwind site. And he did, and he moved to Niigata to be with her. So I guess I could be a certified marriage counselor here, which was really touching personally. But besides that, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but it talks about the power of the internet to speak truth to power. I mean, here's a, you know, we have a small little nonprofit, and we are making enormous influence in a country that's half a world away. The third trip was a long one. It was a month, and it involved about 60 speeches and days of sample collection in Japan. On our website, the Fairwinds website, there's a Japan tour speaking series. And what I would do is I'd call Maggie via Skype, and she would record it. And there's about five of my recollections of things that I experienced there. A couple of the things I experienced were the amazing quantity of bags of radioactive waste. Now, each one of those black bags is a meter, about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, and it weighs a ton. And I saw about a couple hundred thousand bags of waste scattered throughout the entire prefecture, including in people's backyards, and they were still in their homes. In fact, there's 30 million bags of waste throughout the prefecture. Think about that. That's 30 million tons of waste throughout the prefecture. And that only includes cleanup of 5% of the prefecture. They can't clean the mountains. What they're doing is they're cleaning the streets, they're cleaning next to the streets, they're cleaning the buildings, but they're not cleaning the surroundings. That's an important thing for a little bit later. This is me in a car with the windows closed. And although you can't see it in this picture, the radiation levels in that car are 15 times higher with the windows closed, 15 times higher than they are in Burlington, Vermont, where I'm from. One of the most important scientific discoveries I made was on the roof of the Minamisoma Town Hall. Minamisoma was one of those communities that had been evacuated early, but the people were now told it was clean enough to come back into. The Minamisoma Town Hall had been completely decontaminated, and a nice fresh coat of green epoxy paint had been laid on the roof, and on top of that had been placed solar collectors. Well, so that was 3 years after the disaster. They cleaned the roof and they put solar collectors on. And I was there 5 years after the disaster. I took samples. Guess what? There was highly radioactive dust on the roof, four stories high, of the Minamisoma Town Hall that had been previously cleaned. Well, how can that be? Then, of course, what's happening is if you don't clean the whole prefecture, the dirt and dust from the surrounding mountains blows back in. So, and it's not just the roof of that school. What I found personally upsetting is probably too light a word. It was heartfelt pain. I would see little girls riding down the street on their bicycles in the dirt on the side of the road, the dust on the side of the road, knowing that those tires were throwing up the same radioactive dirt that I had discovered on the roof of the Minamisoma Town Hall. This one I put in to show the power of the internet. Three colleagues and I were taking radioactive samples at the Soma family temple. right on the outskirts of Minami-soma. And we were walking around and talking, and the priest heard us and came down those stairs behind us. He walked by my three other colleagues. He walked right up to me, stuck his hand out, and said, "I know you. You're on YouTube." I'm not bragging, but think about the power of the internet. That's really the bottom line here, is that as citizens, we have something that the people in Chernobyl didn't have and the people at Three Mile Island didn't have, but it is a tool that we can use to speak truth to power. This is a displaced village. 160,000 people were evacuated their homes after the disaster, 160,000. And Japan set up these, I almost want to call them refugee camps, but they are villages for displaced people. And in this particular one, there were 60 or 70 families that came from the same town and had moved to this. The town was much bigger than 60 or 70, so some of their friends were in other villages, and they had been displaced to the far end of Fukushima Prefecture. I got to meet with the people in that community, and they all experienced symptoms of illness from radiation. They all experienced something that scientists don't know what causes, but there's a metallic taste in your mouth that they all experienced, and it seems to be somehow related to a physiological effect of inhaling radioactive material. Everyone experienced that. One woman had, she lost her hair. She had a bloody nose for 2 to 3 months. Her exposed skin had blotches on it. And when she went to the doctor, he said, "It's stress." Another woman was evacuated very quickly from her home when she heard the sirens go off. And she ran barefoot across the lawn and got in her car and drove to the evacuation center. She was so radioactive, she was not allowed in. Her feet turned black for 3 years, and her dog died 1 week afterward. Another man, who was a fisherman, he came back in. He was out fishing on the day of the disaster. And he came back in, and he said, he noticed what he said was a strange sunburn. He was sunburned through his clothes. And afterward, 2 or 3 days afterward, layers of his skin, he said 2 or 3 layers of his skin were sloughing off in sheets. That's a sign of the amount of radiation that was not measured because there weren't detectors working at the time, but to which the population was exposed. My hats are off to the women in these villages. When I met, that picture previously was one of the few that actually had men in it. Whenever I met with the villagers, it was the women who came forward and discussed the problems, and the men would not come out. And within Japan, there's a schism between the thoughts of the Japanese women and the thoughts of the Japanese men on nuclear power. The men trust the government. And don't worry, be happy. And the women are much more questioning and concerned about future generations. So I met on the third tour more of these women that were going through Fukushima divorces. This is a mother from Fukushima, and this picture was taken about 200 miles south of the disaster area. She moved there with her kids, and her husband remains in Fukushima. The husband, after 5 years, sued her for divorce, and as part of the divorce, he wants the kids back. He wants the kids to go back into Fukushima Prefecture. That's bad. But what's worse is that her own parents are supporting the husband to get the kids to move back into Fukushima Prefecture. And their logic is the government says it's safe, so therefore it's safe. And what's more of a concern to me is that the court system in Japan is supporting the husbands as well because the government says it's safe. So the example I had in Niigata is in fact a rare one. In fact, it's much more likely that these Fukushima divorces end in where the mother takes the kids back and lives in a contaminated environment in order to remain married to her husband. Dr. Mehta is one of my personal heroes. I met him on this third trip as well. Dr. Mehta ran a clinic in Fukushima Prefecture and diagnosed people with radiation illness. But the government refused to pay the bills unless he changed the diagnosis to stress. And Dr. Mehta refused. And he closed his clinic and left the prefecture rather than change his diagnosis. And in the process, suffered a huge financial loss as well, because none of those patients that he saw was he ever compensated for. One of my personal heroes. Where did all this, for the first 5 years, I was collecting samples, and this all led to a peer-reviewed paper that Dr. Marco Kaltofen and I have published. Dr. Kaltofen is at Worcester Polytechnic in Massachusetts, and the journal is called Staten. It's called Science of the Total Environment. What we discovered, based on all this data that we've collected, is this. We have the largest database of dirt and dust samples in the world. We had about 200 samples of dirt from America and Canada, and about the same number of samples from dirt in Japan. Now, this is my geek moment here, so you got to bear with me. This is it. If you remember, the center line in a highway is called the median. Well, the median of data is you stack all the data out in a row and from the lowest to the highest. And the median radiation in America is about 2 becquerels per kilogram. Just remember 2. It's two. In a kilogram of dirt, there's 2 disintegrations every second. That's the median in America, largely from bomb testing. So 2 is the number for America. In Japan, the median is 3,000. So it's 1,000 plus times higher than the median in America. Now that's a concern enough, but the bigger concern is the rest of the data. The mean, which is just the average, is 9 times higher than the median. And 5% of the data is 10,000 times higher than the median. Now, what does that mean? It's my geek moment here. That means that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency's dose model for the Japanese is wrong. That they're assuming sort of a uniform distribution of radiation in what's being inhaled or what's being imbibed. But what we discovered is it's not uniform. And there's a significant 5%+ of the particles that these people are inhaling are much larger than the IAEA allows. So the exposure to those individuals over 10 or 15 or 20 years, because remember, these particles are so small, they don't leave your lungs. They don't leave your liver. They will cause a significant increase in cancers over the years that the IAEA and the Japanese government are refusing to acknowledge. The Staten paper, by the way, is in the top 3% of all of the academic journals that have been published in the last couple of years, as measured by a company that measures it called Altmetrics. So it's being well read, but we've got no feedback yet. Okay, trip number 4. This is the one that just ended a couple months ago. The woman. This is a miraculous group of people. The woman on the left with the red hair is a bomb survivor from Nagasaki. They call them hibakusha, and so she is a Nagasaki hibakusha. The woman next to her is a mother of 2 children, who became an expert in the incineration of waste to protect her community and to protect her her children. The guy in the middle with the hat is a welder from Fukushima Daiichi who lost his house. The man in the front with the red shirt on is a farmer whose entire herd was radioactively contaminated. The tall guy in the back with the yellow shirt is a hibakusha from Hiroshima. So we've got we've got Nagasaki, Hiroshima, Fukushima. They should be the bookends on history in this picture. And the woman on the far right is the wife of the guy with the yellow shirt. And of course there's Dr. Kaltofen and me. And these were my traveling buddies for 2 weeks. Well, here's what we found. First off, wild boar are proliferating in the prefecture. It used to be that farmers would kill the wild boar and eat it, but now they're so radioactively contaminated they can't eat them. The government has developed an incinerator that can burn 600 wild boar a year, but they're proliferating faster than they can be destroyed. And there's no bounty on them to reduce the herd. I was there for 7 days and I saw three of them. They are proliferating like an unmanaged deer herd, and literally they are everywhere. Not only are they highly radioactive, but they're notoriously mean anyway. So I was walking on a path in the woods taking samples, and there was a sign in Japanese, and I turned to my friend who was Japanese. They said, "What does that mean?" He says, "Warning, this is a wild boar path." So we very quickly decided it was time to move on from there. The farmer I showed you in that picture, this is his farm. He was told by the Japanese government that he would that he needed to destroy his herd, and he refused. He said, "You know, my cows didn't cause this problem. Why should they be my cattle? This was a cattle farm. Why should they be killed?" And he refused to slaughter the herd. So they're living a natural life on contaminated soil, and as they die, they die. This is me taking a tooth sample from the skull of one of the dead animals, and that's being analyzed in the lab. But I wanted to talk to you about this farmer, because this is another one of my heroes. First off, he stood up to the Japanese government and refused to destroy his herd. But the second thing he did is he took the manure, put it in a wheelbarrow, and walked to Tokyo, 120 miles away, and dumped it on the steps of Tokyo Electric. Now that's speaking truth to power. This was a children's playground that was in use. Kids are playing on this playground. And the reading on my radiation detector is 70 times higher than what we're getting right here today. So the background in that children's playground is 70 times higher than the background you and I are exposed to. The village elders are refusing to close the school. They realize that if they close the school, they lose the heart of the community because the kids won't be there. And they would rather sacrifice the kids or put the kids at risk than to fundamentally change the life in the village. This is the Fukushima workers' abandoned home. It was his dream house. It was on the end of a cul-de-sac with a gorgeous view of the mountains in the background. I think you can see in the haze. It is so contaminated, there's nothing they can do to clean it up. I went in with my radiation detector and it pegged the meter. I could not measure how high the radiation was at the side of his home. Now think about that. This was his dream house. And he built it just about 2 years before the disaster. And he will never, ever get to spend another night in it. This is this stadium is going to be used for the Olympic baseball games. It's a gorgeous stadium. It's in the middle of Fukushima Prefecture. Oh. And it's been placed, the choice of using this stadium as opposed to another stadium anywhere else in Japan is obviously to show the world that it's over. The disaster's over, you can come back in and you can play ball. And it's a gross public relations ploy, risking athletes and the people who observe the events. These are clothes from a Fukushima Daiichi worker, not somebody who was in the plant, but somebody who was working on the piles of those bag piles. And we have a complete set of his clothes, his socks, his boots, his gloves, his undergloves, his pants, his shirt, and the cross-hatching, the safety cross-hatching that he wore. When we analyzed it, we found out that it was highly radioactive. Now, these people are recruited for these jobs from throughout Japan, and they go home on weekends. And we found that the most highly radioactive piece of his clothing was his crotch. Mm-hmm. Think about that. So these guys are leaving the prefecture on a weekly basis to go home to their families. And you can't tell me that some of the contamination on the clothing does not get either imbibed or stuck to their skin as well. This is a scanning electron microscope. That thing in the background is a scanning electron microscope. It costs about $3 million. And you recall the picture at the very beginning was a scanning electron microscope photograph. So this was in a lab that had just been opened by the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency. And they showed Dr. Kaltofen and I their entire lab. And Dr. Kaltofen asked a great question. He said, you know, we've got our data out there, and you know, have you read our report? Which they hadn't. And he said, well, where is your data? This lab is as good as the work we're doing at Worcester Poly. And the director, who's over there on the left, said, oh, we take great data. We're just not publishing it. So they're not letting scientists know. They're not letting doctors know. And they're certainly not letting the professional literature know what we have found. They can do quality work and probably are doing quality work. They're just refusing to publish it. And anybody who's familiar with the scientific method here, you know, it works only when people share data. And when you refuse to share data, I think that says a lot about concerns beyond the data. Well, to kind of summarize my experiences in Japan, I have become sort of a friend to Naoto Kan. Naoto Kan was the Prime Minister of Japan before Abe, and he was the person who was in charge on the during the period of the disaster began. We all know when Fukushima ends began and when Chernobyl began, but there's no end on them. That, you know, we have a beginning, but they just go on forever. But Naoto Kan said to me, our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. And I talked to him about the decision to evacuate Tokyo or not. And I said, you know, given the information he had, I think he made the right decision. And he said to me, he said, Arnie, the information I received, and this is from METI, the regulator, and from Tokyo Electric, said the information I received was neither accurate nor timely. Now, how can you regulate when your staff and Tokyo Electric are telling you lies, and when they tell you it, it's already old news? That's what Naoto Kan had to face. In addition, of course, if you read Gorbachev's memoirs, he credits the collapse of the Soviet Union, not the perestroika. Perestroika is the open government that the communist state was moving to. He said, we didn't fail because of perestroika. We failed because of Chernobyl. So nuclear is a technology that can destroy the fabric of a country overnight. And there's nothing like that on the planet. You know, if a coal plant blows up, it blows up. But when a nuclear plant blows up, it destroys the fabric of a country overnight. So my hats are off to the women of Japan for stepping up and taking the lead politically on this environmental issue. The numbers are about 80% of the women want nuclear closed down, and slightly less than half of the men want nuclear closed down. The net effect is 60 to 70% of the total population wants nuclear closed down, and yet the Abe administration continues to start up these plants that have been deferred. And the reason for that is the pressure from the banks, who want their money back. So to close now, let's talk about Dresden versus Chicago. The crow flight distance from Dresden to Chicago is 47 miles. Most of the data I took was beyond 47 miles from Fukushima. And in addition, Fukushima is contaminating the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific is 30,000 times bigger than all of the Great Lakes combined. So if a nuclear plant can contaminate the Pacific Ocean, think what it can do to the Great Lakes. Radiation knows no borders. Thank you.
Field from University of Chicago.
Say to add to this? I don't think so, but I am really, it's an honor for me to appear with Arnie, and I've learned so much from him, as I'm sure you have too. And so I want to thank Dave too for making this possible for me, to listen to him and then speak to you too with him. And I also want to thank Yuki Miyamoto for putting this all together, and colleagues, former colleagues and friends from the University of Chicago who are coming here on a Saturday towards the end of the busy quarter and who have helped set this up. And all of Dave's lieutenants, what are they, who are here also. So thank you all, because, you know, interest in any issue comes and goes. And if we only had people get interested when a crisis comes, then nothing could be built up. And I have to admit, I felt sad and nostalgic seeing those demonstration photos in Arnie's deck, to know that that has disappeared by and large. People have been persuaded it's not there to their advantage to keep thinking about Fukushima and to keep expressing their views. So I'll get to that. But having some of us just having survived this commemoration week at the University of Chicago, or rather quarter, I've been thinking again about nuclear weapons rather more than I'm accustomed to lately. I've been thinking much more about nuclear reactors, but it's been very salutary in reminding me that these technologies cannot be separated. And they're played off against each other to justify each. So that's I would like to do today a little bit, to think about the linkages by going back historically to the immediate aftermath of CP1. Sometime this summer I realized that everybody's at University of Chicago kept saying, "Oh, CP1, CP1. What are you talking about? Well, Chicago Pile 1. Well, until this summer, no one had talked about CP1. That's the great thing about an advertising business mentality, right? It can make everybody, stubborn individualists at the University of Chicago, talking this line and kind of getting on the bandwagon of celebration. Okay, so, you all know this, but seeing another propaganda piece yesterday at the university made me want to just rehearse this. What are nuclear weapons? What's their justification? Obviously, to protect a country against an external enemy. What about nuclear power? It's supposed to bring prosperity to local and regional communities, right? That's what justifies these two. Everybody has to acknowledge these two somewhat risky technologies. One is intended to be destructive, the first. The second, not to be destructive at all. And then thirdly, which is something I won't talk about very much, medicine, diagnosis, and therapy. There was a wonderful moment yesterday when the moderator kind of slipped out of her bland, safe, soothing moderator's voice. And well, she didn't. She just asked very innocently of the two doctor researchers who were on the nuclear medicine panel, is nuclear medicine related to weapons and defense? And the response that came out was, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. I will say just, you know, I would not hesitate to get radiation therapy or use diagnostic or whatever tools for myself or people I care about or any human being who needs it at the moment. At the same time, the bland defense of it, like I can imagine medicine finally becoming what justifies both the above two. If the first two become too risky in the social psyche. But I will not go into that today, but also note that medical use of radioactivity, of radioactive substances, is another way of in which proliferation takes place on hospital staff, shoes, and so forth and so on. Okay. All right. So science, Arnie had a nice slide about how science is used today, but that's partly what I'm talking about on this slide. It's summoned all the time in Japan, but it happened in Chernobyl, and it happened in the American Southwest, too, and elsewhere. Scientific claims, science is used to claim that health effects are mostly in your head, right? And it's called radiophobia. Some people call it nuclear phobia. Apparently, there's a physician in the Soviet Union who came up with the term radiophobia, but this argument was present from very early on in the US in nuclear weapons sites, that worrying about radiation is worse for you than the actual effects can be. Now, like all half-truths, it's a half-truth, I think, is harder to handle than a complete truth or a complete falsehood, because everybody knows that stress is not good for your health. Living in stress for the people of Fukushima has not been great for their health. So yeah, they have a lot of effects, but that should never, ever be substituted for the actual injuries that they have been and continue to suffer. But when science is summoned like that, it is horrendous. I'll quote Timothy Mousseau, great evolutionary biologist who's worked on the barn swallow in Chernobyl and also has been working in Fukushima too. One thing he will say is that the barn swallow does not suffer from radiophobia. So if changes appear in the barn swallow's body, it must be real in some way and rather than psychic. Well, maybe if we could get therapists for barn swallows, we would find out that Tim is wrong, but in any case. And the other worst thing, I think, science goes one step further in Fukushima, and I'll get back to this later, I hope, is that one of the lasting legacies of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs is discrimination against the victims. So the victims are at least twice victimized. They've had the bombs inflicted on them, and then they have to worry about their children and grandchildren suffering from discrimination in marriage and employment. And this immediately became a hot topic in Fukushima after the disaster. We hear about cars with Fukushima plates being trashed, keyed, whatnot. Parents trying to get their children to boarding schools outside at a very early age. This is not a common practice in Japan because they want their children to break any bureaucratic record of their children's ties to Fukushima, canceled early on so that they won't suffer. So one of the things science has begun to say, and we get that from that slide that Arnie showed, is if you continue to be unscientific and keep expressing your worries about health and about the safety of our food products, you're just inviting discrimination against Fukushima, right? Don't be unscientific. Don't worry about health. And don't be a discriminating jerk, right? Think about your fellow Fukushima citizens and stop talking about worries. You can imagine what kind of pressure this creates on people living in Fukushima who might be worried too. This is slightly different, but the whole issue of progress, right? It struck me listening to a group of ethicists, esteemed ethicists at the University of Chicago Divinity School, where Yuki Miyamoto got her PhD. She's a really solid person. She can stand that. She's brave. She's brave. The ethicist talking, you know, posing this question ponderously, do you ever want to stop science's search for truth? This is very commonplace. It's not just ethicists at the University of Chicago Div School who pose that question. There's something we consider sacred about the scientist's mission. We don't remember that the scientific truths that get found out are usually, now more than ever, scientific truths that have been funded, that have had funding to get there, and that there are many truths that scientists are not able to uncover because they don't have the funding to do it. That's another issue with Fukushima too. So there's that, but there's that kind of sanctity of the scientific mission. I kept hearing that in the background over the University of Chicago commemoration, that this was great science. This is what science was able to discover. And then on a technological level, right, we can produce smaller, more portable nuclear weapons. We can produce small modular reactors, small, portable, safer, so forth and so on. And I think that technological discourse relies tacitly on the sanctity given to scientific knowledge and exploration, and I find it really annoying and dangerous. I had to quote another one from Tim here. In one of his early press conferences at the Tokyo Foreign Correspondents Club, where Arnie also spoke, we had a slide, a reporter said accusingly, people say you're more of an activist and not a scientist. And he said, I'm an activist in favor of evidence-based science, which I think most people should be able to support. All right. Familiar map to many of you, perhaps? I should say that part of the motivation for me in doing this work comes from a friend and colleague I had at the University of Chicago, no longer with us. And she might have been the first person to share this map with me. She was a Hanford downwinder who died of a cancer in her mid-40s. But anyway, a useful map, although no map is complete. It shows areas of the United States crossed by two or more clouds during atmospheric tests in Nevada, 51 to 62. This shows, we should learn to read this map, envisioning Nevada test site workers, atomic veterans, downwinders, as we know, who would include many, many Native Americans. We have to note that up in the Northwest, Hanford in Washington State, maybe the worst cleanup site, not clean-upable site in the United States, which manufactured the plutonium for the Nagasaki bomb. You can't tell the harm that was taking place there, nor can you tell the harm taking place in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. I just read, some of you may have read the news report this week of Eniwetok Atoll, which was one of the places terribly contaminated. And now they're getting a double whammy after having been returned there, having the atoll declared safe for return. Now the rising sea waters will probably make their home disappear. And it has tons and tons of waste irresponsibly dumped there by the United States. So we're not seeing that there. And also, I have to say, these are all testing sites, human radiation testing sites for the United States. And one of the things said about the Marshall Islanders early on, it's a secret project 4.1, was a government official saying of Marshall Islanders, they're not civilized like white people, but, quote, they are more like us than mice. Marshall Islanders are more like us than mice, so it's still worthwhile testing them because that result will get us closer to what's happening to truly civilized white people. All right, this is a book. If you haven't seen it, Carol Gallagher's American Ground Zero. It's an extraordinary book of photographic essays of people impacted, the Nevada test site workers, the atomic veterans and downwind communities. And she takes wonderful, dignified photographs of each of them and gives us a lot of their prose. So this is a person who was in the test site, working in the test site. And you get a very nice, a concise combination of the labor issue, like afraid to complain about what's happening to your health, to lose your job and your income, and the very real bodily harm that this Mr. Prescott is experiencing. Now I want to get right straight to the University of Chicago here. Ed Markey, right? Name many of you will recognize, currently senator from Massachusetts, along with that other famous woman. Pocahontas, thank you. I knew we would get back to Native Americans. Yes. This is a report that came out in 1986 to the House Subcommittee that then Congressperson Markey chaired. I think the title captures it. I mean, we're so unused to hearing honest words spoken out of our Congress that this title, American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, Three Decades of Radiation Experiments on U.S. Citizens, is fantastic. That's exactly what it is. It covers about 31 tests, including 699, about 700 people. There are more complete tests, like Ellen Wilson's plutonium files, and then there's another huge government report that came out under President Clinton. Yes, he did some very good things, genuinely. Anyhow, what is important about this, the University of Chicago comes up about six or seven times in this, along with other institutions like UC Berkeley, UC San Francisco, MIT, labs like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge, and they are busily. Oh, they're doing things like injecting plutonium into terminally ill patients, except that some of them turn out not to be so terminal. They live on for 20 years. I don't know what happened to them, but I can't help thinking that people who were already ill, who don't die from getting plutonium injected into them, but continue to live 20 years, might not have exactly had a robust 20 years to live on. And we don't learn these things from these reports. But a report that particularly caught my eyes, not because it's worse than anything else that we see there, like Marshall Islanders, that doesn't show up at all, is one involving University of Chicago students and staff. 1961 to 63, 102 students and staff were fed actual pieces of Nevada test site fallout or simulated pieces of test site fallout. They were getting worried about all those above ground tests and where's that fallout going since we have a lot of people there. And you need to find out how these radioactive substances pass through the body. So have them ingest it, eat it, in some cases solution, so drink it, and then see what comes out of the body. They also know that not all of it comes out, and they also knew then that internalizing radioactivity is actually more harmful than merely external exposure. I was shocked yesterday at the University of Chicago panel to hear one of the doctor scientists say, the old thing, you've heard it, flying from X to Y is more harmful to you than any radiation you might be exposed to on the ground. Just kept giving these examples of external exposure as if that were the sum of it. Shouldn't scientists be embarrassed to pass off such information, as facts? Okay. Many of you may have seen pictures of American soldiers, atomic veterans, they're called out to witness nuclear explosions. Again, interest in seeing what this stuff does to the human body. Soldiers are very convenient. It's only in the Gulf War that I learned that when you join the Army, you give up a lot of your human rights. You're tested with injections that the FDA hasn't approved yet, et cetera, et cetera. Well, these soldiers' well-being obviously was not being looked after, right? Remember, this is to protect the citizens of the United States, and how many soldiers were exposed in this way. I'm particularly pleased to have found this because this is soldiers watching the explosion of Small Boy. And as you'll see in the text on the right, the actual fallout that was fed University of Chicago students and staff was from Small Boy. I would love to get the survivors in the left hand and the survivors in the right hand together. I don't know, is there a hashtag that would make them recognize themselves? If you think of one, let me know, because they deserve to know, and they deserve to meet each other. They really do, and this should be part of any institution, not just the University of Chicago, reflecting back on this era. Okay. I'm using the Ukrainian romanization of Chernobyl to honor Dave, and I told him I'll switch myself once I can determine what Belarus uses. But in any case, this is a contrast that's often drawn by Japanese activists, that whereas in the former Soviet Union, human beings were moved away from the most contaminated place, in Japan, you keep them on site, and you do what is called decontamination. This is handily captured in Sino-Japanese. Two characters remove pollutant. And most of us now say this is manipulation, deceptive manipulation. All they're doing is moving pollution. Because what are you going to do about this mountainous prefecture, precipitation, etc.? But some of you will immediately think, but the former Soviet Union was huge, right? They had all, and also it was a socialist economy, granted. But one of the things that's been a big topic in Japan for decades now is rural depopulation. There are these limit communities where young people don't exist. It's very hard. There are a lot of rural areas that Fukushima farmers could have been assisted to move to, for instance. And in any case, what's going on is extraordinary criminal. It's just criminal. All right, Arnie had a good picture. I love Arnie's picture of the decontamination bags because it had a tree growing out of it. Let me put it, contextualize this in a different way. It's really hard if you don't go to places that had the earthquake and the tsunami. It's hard to show the damage done to Fukushima by the nuclear disaster. Why? Because radiation's invisible, right? If you're not showing the plant, you're not showing things like the bags. In fact, I had a friend who asked me last year, she said, Norma, I have a bunch of people coming to Fukushima City, and I'm supposed to give them a tour, and I don't know what to show them. And I said, right, you've got to tell them that the minute they get to the station. Tell them it's really hard for me to show you the harm. There's a place in Fukushima City up a hill, so concealed, right? Fukushima City, let's remember, is the prefectural seat of government. It's where the bullet train stops. No way the government was going to evacuate Fukushima City, although it has numerous hot spots. And then the Olympic fields, too. They're bags, but they're on a hilltop, so they can't be seen from below. There are these monitoring posts. The monitoring posts, which are rigged anyway, you know, they might have lead around the bases. Or there was one company that produced a first set of monitoring posts to show the airborne radiation, and it seemed to measure too accurately, so the prefecture commissioned another company. So in many places, oddly enough, you will see two posts side by side, one of which isn't the needle's not moving. Anyway, but even that's kind of iffy. So the point now that there's an effort to remove them. And sometimes the citizens who still have the energy will protest the removal of a monitoring post from their community. But this is one place where we can see the harm. Volume reduction facility. There are a bunch of these that have been built at huge cost. Huge cost. These are temporary facilities. You can imagine that having all those bags around is not good in the recovery campaign, right? And so you have to do something about them. And this is one of the solutions, a volume reduction facility. Arnie can tell us more about how helpful these things are. First of all, by reducing the volume or concentrating the radioactivity, these things are releasing all the time necessarily as part of their operation. And think of what is under the facility in the ground once it's shut up. But I had to take this because it was amusing, this sign to the right, as if this were the major problem, because oddly enough, I've seen two of these facilities right near the community graveyards, the cemeteries, and they want to warn people who are coming to the graves of their family members not to light incense because the air is so dry and might set off a fire. So, and guess what? Your thoughts sincerely sent out will reach your dead loved ones. So don't feel like you have to literally light an incense. And this one, sweetly enough, is from the Village Women Firefighters Association. So that kind of, bureaucratic tragicomedy. There's evidence of that everywhere. Visualizing radioactivity. This was a woman, I believe, who started after the most recent one, late 2011, the most recent example of the red dot drawings that I can find are 2013, which suggests to me that these drawings are no longer acceptable for circulation. The schools, Arnie referred to the doctors, the schools are intent on giving children the proper knowledge about radioactivity, right? For very young children, I went to one of the huge, multi-million, if not billion-dollar complexes with some facilities are for some parts of the facility for research, others for community events. This one had a huge, this was children's, there's a place where you can leave your kids. There are tatami mat rooms, really cozy, kind of sterile, but kind of cozy. Nice space. And then they had a huge screen, and the screen is teaching very young children, preschool children, about alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays. And everybody knows papers, rocks, scissors, right? The children are taught to, as the alpha particle shows up, if you can put out your two fingers, you can conquer that alpha particle with scissors. And beta might be rock. And gamma rays, paper. Anyway, and then there's a sweet young woman there, and there you have the kids. I got one picture with kids and a mother and the woman to encourage them, and they're kind of all bopping around the screen. And say, moms, you're not doing as well as your kids. Come on, let's get in the action. Right, early on, show your children that radioactivity is not to be feared. All right. Thyroid cancer, pediatric thyroid cancer. Sorry, I'm decongested. I'm talking too much. All right. You may have heard that there are extraordinary levels of youth and pediatric thyroid cancer in Japan. And there are, because up to now, it's been considered a very rare form of cancer for children, for this population. Thyroid cancer is on the rise around the world, I have read. But right now, what is it, 193 cases confirmed or suspected. By suspected, suspected only means that the children have not had surgery yet, and therefore without analyzing of the organs, they can't say definitively. Probably that is not the complete picture. However, one of the things that some of you might even remember, the heralded Professor Jerry Thomas, one of the scientists in favor of nuclear, saying right after the Fukushima disaster, thyroid cancer is one of the best cancers you can get. And say that to people having a hard time with their hormones. after thyroid removal. But anyway, because you catch it and it's out and no problems. However, one thing that Fukushima is teaching people, and I don't see enough written on this in English, that thyroid cancer in children and youth seems to move much faster than in adults. And so while the authorities, prefectural medical authorities are busily touting the screening effect that, oh, you know, the Soviets, they didn't have the accurate instruments. We have too many accurate instruments being an advanced country, and that's why we're diagnosing cancers that should just be watched, if anything, that are never going to cause trouble to these kids. In fact, the Prefectural Medical Association, Pediatric Association, last year was proposing that coming up with so many cases of child and youth cancers is causing what? Guess what? Anxiety, stress among the people of Fukushima. It is not beneficial to the people of Fukushima. Therefore, we should start scaling down the screening, right? But the people involved in this, the brave people, one of the scientists who was involved in the parliamentary committee to study the is a champion of this for these children and their families, are saying, no, this is not the screening effect, because we have found among the children and youth who've had surgery, distant metastasis, for example, recurrence. No, we need to be doing this more widely, because the plume didn't stop. The iodine didn't stop. The radioactive iodine did not stop at prefectural borders. But only in Fukushima can you get the screening examination. We should be examining it and more fully, and we should be paying attention. We need to catch these cases early. All right, my theme right now is about the difficulty of making radiation harm visible. So last year, 2016, I thought this was amazing. This was dubbed as the coming out of thyroid cancer families of children. So by children and youth, I mean that the survey began with those who were 18 and under and living in Fukushima at the time. So it was a coming out of these families. Again, remember, we're worried about discrimination. And so that's one of the big snags, and what will surely become more and more urgent is to guarantee free health care for people who experience this, as happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But again, the great worry about being known as having a cancer in your family has kept everyone anonymous and isolated and stressed out. You know, it's another source of stress in families. I read a really painful one of an interview, no names, where a middle school-aged son had to have surgery. And whom did he blame? His mother. Said, you made me with this defective body. Oh. Right? This is the kind of the victims turning, a structure that will make the most vulnerable turn against each other. So they will be too preoccupied, speaking truth to power. Anyway, so I was really looking forward to this press conference, and this is what happened. These are the reporters in a room in Tokyo, and two fathers appeared, and they were speaking from Fukushima, and this was their coming out. We showed only the trunks of their bodies. Their voices were altered so they couldn't be identified. In other words, it's as if they who might make visible evidence of Fukushima health harm had to be made invisible in a way, right? You see, it just keeps on turning on itself and not working to help the people who need the help. And moreover, it's in hiding their faces as if they were criminals, as if they are injuring society, and in a certain logic in Fukushima. This is why I had Olympics in my title. Don't talk about harm in Fukushima. We're getting the Olympics. The Olympics signals our recovery. It's carrot and stick. I don't know how it actually works as a carrot, but certainly a huge stick. Don't you dare say or do anything that suggests it's not safe to be living here. Okay. So this is what I come back to. Who is protected by nuclear weapons? Who's the enemy? And who's made prosperous by nuclear power? I think I'll stop here, but maybe I can just honoring one of the people Arnie traveled with last week, Mary Olson's work on gender and radiation. This is now incorporated in the United Nations, in the preamble to the United Nations ban on nuclear weapons. But this is not anticipation, or prediction, but it is an analysis of the Hiroshima Nagasaki survivors to find that there is a big, well, first of all, young boys are more vulnerable than men, and little girls are even more vulnerable than little boys. So I take this and I keep saying to Mary, how can this message be conveyed in Fukushima without bringing further discrimination against people in Fukushima and against girls in Fukushima, mothers who are terribly anxious that their daughters will not grow up to get married. And some of the more painful kinds of comments we heard early on were kindergartners and preschoolers, girls saying, am I going to be able to get married? Right? Because that kind of anxiety spread very quickly. Okay, thank you.
Seat?
Maybe let's put Arnie in the middle.
All right, what we'll do for the rest of the time, we'll have a short exchange between the presenters, and then we're going to open up for a question and answer. So bear with us a minute. We have to do a little technology shifting here, and then we'll get on with that. So Arnie, would you come up here?
Yes. Why not? Don't you think? No? No?
We'll
oh, Arnie's tall.
As we do this, we have to pass the mic.
Do you want this?
Yeah.
Do you have to move any other mics?
Not for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.